Good morning, 7:41 here on the Mighty 690, and we have the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District in studio. We have Wendy Powell here and Jesse Gilmore. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And Jesse's going first here today, talking, of course, a horticulture agent here, and always good to talk about stuff growing in the garden this time of year. I know everyone's excited about that. And today, you want to talk a little bit about garden sustainability.
Yep. The K-State Garden Hour webinar for the month of May is today from noon to 1, and the topic is going to be on drought-tolerant plants for challenging landscapes.
Yeah.
And that is a really, really important topic with how dry it's been. For people who are unfamiliar with the Kansas mesonet, K-State operates a set of weather stations across the state. And they track local precipitation, things like growing degree days. It's mostly an agricultural tool, but there's some important information in there for gardeners as well. And the thing that has been most interesting to see is the deviation from the average for precipitation rates. And you can track over a day, you can track over a week, month, and you can go for the previous 365 days. There are three mesonet locations in our area. There's one in Sedan, there's one in Parsons, and for the purposes of the district that I work in, there's also one in Columbus. The mesonet station in Sedan is actually the worst station in the state when it comes to comparing the average precipitation versus what we actually got over the last 365 days. The last time I checked, Sedan was 18.5 inches below average for the last 365 days. So that is a very significant drop in expected precipitation versus actual. Parsons was a little better off at 11.5 inches below average, and I believe the Columbus location was 10. And that might have changed a little bit with the recent rains we got, and it's definitely going to change after this weekend with the rains we're supposed to be getting. So hopefully that rain falls evenly across the district, but with changing weather patterns, that can't really be expected at this point.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, with climactic shifts, I mean, people think that, well, the earth is always staying the same, but no, it climate does change, and that's just normal. And the old dividing line, you know, the 100th meridian they talk about, it has moved to the east 140 miles in the last 100 years, and they're saying that's going to probably continue to move. So I just thought that was interesting that, you know, we're seeing parts, and this, of course, being right across Kansas, we're seeing that arid kind of climate start to inch closer to our area.
Yeah, so if you look at expected precipitation maps, there's a very distinct gradient from southeast to northwest. As you head farther west, you see a major drop-off in expected rainfall. The average rainfall for southeast Kansas, depending on which county you're looking in, is about 45 inches a year, which is nothing to sneeze at. Actually, that's more rain than Seattle gets in a year, and they're known for their rainfall. Mostly they're just cloudy. But yeah, you are seeing that drop-off in precipitation, and that's impacting a lot of garden plants. I have had many, many, many calls over the last couple of months about trees that should have been leafing out and aren't, and it turns out that they are dead, and that is likely due to just how stupid hot and dry it was last summer, and also potentially some winter drought injury, which I will touch on at near the end. But that is the reason why we are talking about sustainability in the Garden Hour. And I wanted to mention a couple of ways that gardeners and fruit and vegetable growers can make their gardens more sustainable so that they are not pouring as many resources into their landscapes as they might need to for this upcoming summer. If it stays as hot and dry as it was last year, hopefully it doesn't, but hope for the best, prepare for the worst. So your first tactic for making your landscape more sustainable is to select the right plants. and focus mostly on native plants. Now, that's not to say that introduced plants can't be drought tolerant. They definitely can, but they will take more work to get established into the new environment that they are not used to, whereas native plants, because they have lived and reproduced in the area, they are going to be more adaptable to the local climate. So any native plant is one that was found out in the wild in our geographic area. Sometimes native plants are just native to North America. Sometimes they're native to Eastern North America. Sometimes they're native to Kansas specifically. The more specific you get with the native geographic range, the more success you're going to have. So what works in the Eastern United States or the East Coast might not work in Kansas's specific climate. So the more filtered down you can get for native range, the better. Kansas has a couple of really good publications on native plants for our area. These are going to be really low input perennials like penstemon. Penstemon, wildflowers like blanket flower, which is the state flower of Oklahoma and one of my favorite garden flowers as far as visuals go. Things like that. The locality where you can find seeds from, if you can go out and collect seeds, that's known as provenance, or provenance if you're feeling particularly fancy.
French. It sounds French.
Yeah, but the more local you can source your seeds from, the more adaptable they're going to be to your area.
Is echinacea native?
Echinacea is a native. Okay. That's going to be cone flowers. Most cone flowers that you can find at garden centers are not going to be native colors. And they're bred specifically for their colors in the landscape. Color is important if you are trying to plant echinacea for the purposes of supporting pollinators, because most like really hot pink type echinacea, which is the color you see far and away most often in garden centers, that's not actually, it is natural, but that's not going to support pollinators in the same way that yellows or purples would. But yes, echinacea is another good cone flower. It is a cone flower. It's another good native plant to select for your landscape. So native plants almost always are going to be more drought tolerant and heat tolerant than introduced plants will. There are introduced plants that will function in a drought tolerant landscape, but you need to be much more selective with those. Most of the time when you're selecting introduced plants, they're going to be from Asia, typically China, and the climate in China varies wildly.
Oh, I bet.
Depending on where it's native in China or Western Europe also, or Eastern Europe also has quite a few introduced species that function in ornamental landscapes. You just need to look at the climate. Your second thing that you can do to really, when we're talking about sustainability, we're talking about water. A lot of plants can tolerate our heat. A lot of plants can tolerate our winters. If you look at the USDA's hardiness zone map, that is specifically for the coldest that it gets during the year. And that's just describing how tender the plant is to frost and freeze injury. There is an equivalent map called the AHS heat zone map. And this will track how many days, I believe over 84 degrees Fahrenheit, you can expect in your area during any given year. The more AHS heat days you get, the higher your zone number is going to be. It does not have as much research put into it as the hardiness zone map does for the USDA, but AHS is the American Horticultural Society. It is becoming more common on plant labels, and it is another piece of information specifically for how hot it gets in our area, whereas the hardiness zone map is just for how cold. So it's a good balance of what you can expect the plant to do during the summer and during the winter. There are pages on the Missouri Botanical Garden website that will tell you the AHS zone rating for different plants. If you are looking for information on specific plants and the extension service in your state does not have it, the Missouri Botanical Garden website is an absolutely fantastic resource for that kind of thing. They are doing all different kinds of planting, and they are cataloging every plant that they grow at the botanical garden. And it's a fairly similar climate to what you can expect in southeastern Kansas, northwestern Arkansas, southwestern Missouri. I believe northeastern Oklahoma also has a pretty similar climate as far as rain and summer heat goes.
Sure.
So just the four-state area, you can expect pretty similar numbers. And similar plants that work at the Missouri Botanical Garden will also work here. But for maintaining water during the summer, mulch. Mulch is going to be your best friend. Anything you can do to keep the sun from hitting bare soil is going to preserve water in the soil for longer. Because when you have the water in the top layer of soil, it is very prone to evaporation loss. So the longer that the sun hits, and especially the hotter that the air, hotter and drier the air is, any water that just stays in the top layer of soil, which for most landscape plants is going to be the only water you're going to put on there, if you're watering for longer, you're likely trying to establish new trees. Whereas most perennial herbaceous plants or annual herbaceous plants, they are only going to need the top 3 to 4 inches of soil to be wet. So if the top 3 to 4 inches of soil are wet, but the sun is hitting the surface of the soil, that water is evaporating out, and it's basically acting like a tow truck pulling all of the water from deeper into the soil out with it because of the cohesion that water molecules go through. They naturally attract each other, and so they're going to basically just act like a chain going up into the atmosphere to make it more humid right around the soil surface. But if the water is evaporating out, the plant can't use it at that point. So putting some kind of mulch on top of the soil to absorb some of the heat that the sunlight is beaming down onto the surface will help keep water in the soil longer for plants to use. And you will end up not needing to water as frequently, which I know for some people was a very, very intense struggle last year. I've had a couple of people call me about putting sod in May, which might have been the worst time to put sod in, but through no fault of their own, it was just really, really bad luck with the timing. So mulching, you can put pretty much anything down for mulch. I've seen, you know, wood chips as a mulch. That's pretty common in garden centers and hardware stores. I've seen people put down straw. I've seen people put down rubber as a mulch.
Oh.
Rubber's not a great choice for vegetable gardens because of, you know, some chemicals that can leak out of the rubber. Usually when you see rubber mulch, it's going to be recycled tire rubber, which is a good way to recycle, but not great for chemicals that might end up in the soil. Plus, most rubber mulch is going to be black, which is actually going to absorb heat instead of reflect it.
What about those cotton holes that are the ground up? I think I've seen those before.
Cotton holes, I have not seen those used as a mulch, but really any organic material that you can get down onto the soil. I've heard of people mulching with sweet gum balls, which might actually be the only useful thing. Those
everyone hates those.
I will not get on my soapbox about sweet gum trees. If you need a good shade tree and can tolerate the fruit balls, that is one of the best drought tolerant trees you can
no
get.
No one's figured out an effective way to pick them up though, other than just
raking them. I've heard of people rolling over them with nut collectors. Yeah. When they're trying to collect pecans, mm-hmm. they end up collecting the sweet gum balls instead. And so that's one way you at least don't need to bend down and pick them up, because those things are projectile weapons when run over with a lawnmower.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, no, sweet gum, good example of a drought-tolerant tree. But sweet gum balls can be used as mulch if you have a sweet gum tree or have a neighbor who has a sweet gum tree. I am sure they would be more than willing to give you the sweet gum balls to use as a mulch. You don't need to worry about seedlings of sweet gum trees if you did use the sweet gum balls as a mulch. I've never seen sweet gum trees growing as volunteers. so that is, I think, one of the only ways you can use those. But anything to keep the sunlight off of the soil for as long as possible. The nice thing about using straw or some other organic material as a mulch is that you can till it in at the end of the growing season, and you've got a good source of improving the physical properties of the soil by adding organic matter back in. It is usually pretty easy to find straw or hay to use as a mulch. Traditionally, you don't see that used as mulch in, like, landscaping beds. That's more of a garden.
Sure.
But mulching also has other benefits as well. In addition to water preservation, you're keeping weeds down, which means that you're not going to spend as much time pulling weeds or spraying for weeds. If you can spray for weeds, you are not going to be using as much of, the chemical, which increases your environmental sustainability.
So as we kind of wrap up here this segment, Jesse, any other final thoughts on this, and how can people get a hold of you if they have questions?
Sure. So two final thoughts. The first, I get asked a lot if types of wood mulch matter. Cedar mulch is going to be the best at pest prevention, but it is also going to be the most expensive. Cedar wood is naturally pest repellent for most insects that are going to be attacking your garden. But do keep in mind that it will repel some beneficial insects as well. So if you have a high population of lacewings or ladybugs, cedar mulch might not be the best choice. Pine mulch is also common. I get asked about dyed mulch, different colors for visual flair in the landscape. I see a lot of red dyed mulch. Dye is not going to be a huge issue unless you are getting it dyed something dark, like dark brown or black, because that is, again, going to absorb more heat down to the soil surface than any lighter dyed mulch. Rocks also absorb heat. So if you're putting rocks or like river rock into a garden bed, that is going to pull heat in, and your bed is going to dry out actually even faster than if there was nothing on the soil surface. So rocky beds need much more drought-tolerant plants. But if anyone has any questions about sustainability in the landscape or is interested in registering for the Garden Hour, they can call any of our offices in the district. My home office number is 620-724-8233.
All right. Thanks, Jesse. And we'll be back with more right after this. Back here at 811 on the Mighty 690, we are now joined by Wendy Powell, and livestock production agent for the Wildcat District. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Doing well. And we're cruising on through. We're talking with Jesse here. I know we were just off here talking about the latest drought numbers. Are not looking too promising for our forecast here. So.
No, we're really not. It's sad.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. As we said, we're hoping to get some rain, at least for southern Kansas. It seems to kind of skirt around southeast Kansas. I don't know why. Northeast Oklahoma doing a little bit better than that. Mm-hmm. But hey, as we had here in Coffeyville just this past weekend, we had the high school rodeo and a lot of horses here in town, and a lot of kids, working on that and getting their rodeo time in. And so today you want to talk a little bit about transporting horses safely.
Yeah, there's actually quite a lot of information out there about transporting horses. So whenever you maybe do a Google search or something, look for a .edu or a .gov website, because There was some really strange tips out there. So just be careful when you're looking for tips.
Well, and sometimes too, you know, you run across particular brands, and no offense against any particular brand, but they may be trying to steer you towards a horse trailer that they make that might not actually even be the right size. And that's something that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. So size does matter whenever it comes to transporting horses. The horse needs to have just a little bit of room to move, because they'll, as they're hauling in the trailer, they kind of brace themselves. They kind of have their sea legs. So they need to be able to adjust their footing a little bit. They need non-slip flooring. That's really important. So if you're going on long hauls, you'll want to provide some bedding that can be changed out and make for sure that floor stays non-slip throughout the trip. And then ventilation and airflow are incredibly important. So horses in a trailer, they create a lot of heat. The excrement that they add to the trailer adds heat. So it's actually a good idea to put a thermometer in the trailer with the horses that's connected to your vehicle so that you can actually see what the temperature is.
Yeah, you can get those for like $10 at the hardware store. That's a really, yeah, a really easy way to keep an eye on things.
Yes, absolutely. Especially, you know, right now we've got construction. We're waiting long periods of time between pilot cars. And so anytime traffic is stopped and there's no air flowing through those trailers, even a stoplight, then that temperature in the trailer is going to escalate. And we don't want to stress those horses any more than they already are.
Sure. And, you know, some horses are going to do a lot better with transport than others. I've seen this firsthand where, you know, you'll have ones that'll go right in and others that are going to have no part of it. And you may need to spend literally months of training to get them comfortable with going into a trailer. So what are some things that we need to do to prepare a horse for transport?
Absolutely. That's a great point. We definitely want to do a health checkup. You know, make for sure they have sound feet and legs, their airways are good to go, make sure they're up to date on their vaccinations and deworming protocols. And then always before a long haul, you want to make for sure the horse is well rested and fed before the trip, because they won't really eat, a lot of horses won't really eat or drink while traveling. And so starting off the trip with a full belly is a good idea. If you've got a horse that has not been hauled a lot, it would be good to do some training. You know, just as you said, they don't always load easily, and so practice makes perfect in these situations. There's lots of ideas out there to get horses to load properly. You know, you can just feed in the trailer for a while without actually hauling anywhere, and then unload the horse whenever he's done eating. Go on short trips, things like that. So gradually increasing the distance and the stress of those transportation adventures can definitely add to that training experience.
I know one particular horse that had to go to the vet and did not like the trail. You could hear him stamping in that trailer on the bad leg, which, you know, is always
of course,
you know what they do.
Of course, highly agitated.
Yeah,
there.
Let's make everything worse. So
yes,
yeah, it's one of those things where it really depends on the animal, and you obviously got to know your animal. So what do we need to do when we're loading the trailer? What are some steps and things we want to have on hand?
Yeah, so like I mentioned earlier, horses they tend to not eat or drink while traveling, but then also when you reach your destination, sometimes they're kind of finicky about, you know, their new surroundings and what's going on. So it's good to have feed buckets or water buckets from home. That way the horse can gradually become accustomed to their new surroundings. Definitely bring feed from home that they're familiar with. And then if your trailer space allows, try to bring some water from home. That way the taste or the smell is the same. Use their same water buckets, especially during the trip. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But during the trip, you want to offer some of that as well. Throw in a first aid kit. And so when I say first aid kit, I don't mean for us folks that are driving them to their destination, but throw in some anti-inflammatory for those horses. When they have their sea legs and they've got, they're trying to stay upright, then sometimes those muscles can get stressed. So throwing in some, what's commonly called bute will be really helpful. A variety of bandages, you know, vet wrap that self sticks, the non-stick kind, bandage scissors, some rubbing alcohol will be good, electrolytes. So just like I mentioned earlier, if a horse isn't drinking during the trip, then when they reach their destination, then dehydration is a problem. So adding some electrolytes to their water is helpful. eyewash because there's a lot of dust and all the nastiness that goes through a trailer. Just like with good ventilation, we also get circulation of other things. A thermometer to stay on top of the horse's temperature. And we'll talk about that a little bit later with shipping fever as well. And then antiseptic ointment. So if a horse does end up getting agitated and injuring themselves, we want to be able to treat that properly.
So, and especially, you know, when you're actually going to load the horses, you know, some horse trailers, you can get several in. So anything we should know on that?
Yeah. So you'll notice in horse herds that there's like a boss horse and then some that kind of they're towards the back of the line and they're the low man on the totem pole, if you will. So horses definitely have their own social hierarchy and you'll want to load the horses in that order. So you can prevent some disagreements, squabbles in the trailer. It would be really nice to do that with kids sometimes too, but you can do it with horses intentionally. So just load the horses according to their social hierarchy. And if you know that a couple of horses don't get along, then make sure you put some space or another horse in between them. And then whenever you actually are loading the horses, tying them, this is kind of one of those... Don't tie them, tie them. It depends on the trailer. It depends on how many horses you have, how much room they have to move around, how long they're going to be in the trailer, things like that. So tying the horses, if you do tie to whatever mechanism is in the trailer, you want to make for sure you're using a quick release knot. That way the horse, if you're in an accident or the horse does become agitated, you can get them released from that situation quickly. And then the length of the tie is very important. So especially whenever we're talking about shipping fever, if you tie the horse too close, so like they don't have enough length of rope to put their head down and cough, then they can't clear their airway. Mm. And so that's going to lead to some breathing problems and increase the probability of shipping fever. So if you tie them too long, though, they can become entangled in that rope or with each other, things like that. So there's this sweet spot, you might say, of the length of the tie for the horse. So sometimes it's 2 foot. It really just depends on how big your horse is, where the tie is located on the wall of the trailer. So you got to use some good judgment there.
Well, and then the other thing is something you want to keep your own personal safety in mind, too, when you're loading. I mean, I've seen times where, you know, you have a bigger horse. It's maybe a little uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. He steps the wrong way, that sort of thing. You just want to make sure you got a plan of escape if you're, you know, getting that tack room or get that out that door, that sort of thing. If you have to, just something that you kind of want to keep in the back of your mind, I would say.
Yes, absolutely. Being in the trailer with animals is always a dangerous situation. You just want to make for sure you have your escape route always forefront of mind.
Absolutely. So, yeah. So once we got the horse in, we're ready to transport. What are some of the things that we need to be monitoring during transport?
Yeah, so like I mentioned earlier, that temperature is really important so that the horses don't get too stressed out or overheated or cold whenever we're hauling during cold temperatures. Here in Southeast Kansas, that might not be the case often, but I know a lot of folks do go north with our stock. So regular checks on the temperature, overall condition. If you're in a long haul, maybe consider stopping to rest every 2 to 3 hours. And by rest, I mean getting that horse to stretch, relax, because they tend to be stiff in those trailers and try to stay upright. And especially if the drive has been difficult, then a lot of jerks and things like that, the horses will be unsteady and maybe they just need some fresh air too. So every 2 to 3 hours, if you can stop, offer some water. If you can offer water from home, that is ideal. So the horses are encouraged to drink. And all of these tips are going to be in prevention of shipping fever. So shipping fever is a respiratory condition. It's not really a disease so much, but it can turn into a disease. Could turn into pneumonia, other problems. So like I said, with the coughing, the horse has to be tied with the ability to lower their head and cough, because horses can't just cough with their head up in the air. So kind of like humans, we kind of tip our chin a little bit and get a good cough and clear the airway. It's really important for horses to do that too, especially when there's dust from the bedding kind of flying around the trailer, or if you're driving on dirt roads, things like that, just air particles, microbes that get stuck in the airway, especially if you have an athletic horse and you're hauling for racing rodeos and you're depending on that horse to perform once you reach your destination, then it's really important to give that horse the ability to breathe. So that's essentially what some of the tips are transporting your horse safely. Of course you want to map out your route. If it's a overnight haul, make sure your, overnight camp out spot has a place for your horse. A lot of times fairgrounds could be an option. There's all kinds of stables around that offer assistance in this way. And then just visiting with other horse people. It's a whole community all in themselves, and they know where the good spots are or where to avoid, things like
and
that.
And you got those horse motels and everything too. Yes. Like you see around. Yes. Now, since we do anything specifically, we've got a lot of state lines in the area for horses in this region. Is there anything we really need to know or do when we're crossing state lines with a large animal like this?
That's an excellent question. I did not read up on the regulations, but I do know that there are some Coggins tests that might need to be paperwork kept with you as you cross state lines, and you might have a vet check at the state line. Any sort of CVI, certified vet inspection paperwork, should have that. And that kind of goes into that health checkup situation there. Another piece of paperwork to have in there, if you have some sort of accident, make sure you have your contact information and the horse information in both the truck and in the trailer. There's been just a lot of happenings that if it's in two different places, then maybe somebody can find it.
Sure.
So you definitely just want to be safer than sorry. And also, if you're not comfortable transporting your horse, like you've got a horse that just needs to go to a new owner, or whatever the situation might be, there are professional horse haulers out there, and they usually have top-of-the-line vehicles, top-of-the-line trailers, and they will work with you to make for sure that your horse is delivered to its destination safely.
Absolutely. No, that is a great reminder there. Yeah, if you're not comfortable, might seek some professionals who do it every day.
Yes.
And that can be some money well spent on that.
Yes. So, I'm sure it's money well earned, too.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. they definitely earn it. So Wendy, if people have questions about this or any other livestock production topics, how can they get a hold of you?
Yeah, you can holler at me at the Altamont Extension office. That phone number is 620-784-5337.
Okay. Well, Wendy, another great topic, and always good to have you here in studio. And do you have anything else that you want to let us know about here today?
Yes. Our spring crop field day is coming up on May 23rd, so mark your calendars for that. It'll begin at 8 a.m. there at the Parsons Research Station right off of Highway 400.
Excellent. Well, that's going to be a good one. I hope people can take advantage of all of that. So, all righty. Well, thank you once again, Wendy, and we look forward to chatting again soon.
Okay, thanks.
But just a few minutes away from Open Line, that's coming up here on the Mighty 690.